For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, here with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to which, as always, you should subscribe, as you should donate to support our work if you don't already. And then, to thank the viewers in Romania, who've made it number 27 on our list of all-time views by jurisdiction, I will not attempt a cheesy Halloween Dracula accent. No, really, I won't. What is scary, though, is the journalistic habit of putting experts say into a headline where random leftists say would be more accurate and more honest. You know, the ones like, quote, experts warn U.S. should prepare for disasters more intense than all hurricanes on record, end quote. And as the Free Press editors recently pointed out, quote, one of the great lessons of the past decade is that when you read a variation of experts say in a headline, you ought to think twice and for yourself, end quote. Which we were reminded of when the herd of independent minds in the mainstream press rushed to announce that experts had said the Department of Energy Red Team report on climate had been like totally debunked, man, except for all the grudging concessions about where it got things right. The New York Times got into the game, emailing top stories that included, quote, scientists say that President Trump's climate report is full of errors and cherry-picked data, end quote. Which links to a story headline, quote, scientists denounce Trump administration's climate report, end quote, that blares, quote, scores of researchers reviewed the Energy Department's argument about greenhouse gases and found serious deficiencies, end quote. And on it goes, throwing mud up, including about peer review. The closest it came to addressing what's in the report, rather than the shrill cancellation effort, is a couple of passages such as, quote, for example, the Energy Department report states that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that helps plants grow, and therefore more gas would improve agricultural yields, end quote. Which, of course, it is. So the deficiency is that it's true and they don't like it. So, they immediately add, quote, the scientific review points out that the Energy Department report sidesteps the negative impacts of global warming on plant life, including extreme heat, drought, wildfires, and floods, end quote. The review in question being a hasty 439-page demolition led by Andrew Dressler of Texas A&M, quote, that essentially serves as a peer review, end quote, without being, you know, peer review. But as Roger Pilkey Jr. warns all those with ears to hear, science is not a team sport. And while Dressler called the DOE report a rude word for cow poop that we refuse to reprint or say, Pilkey says, quote, I took a look at the DK25 report in my areas of expertise, as I did with the DOE CWG, and I found numerous statements that were simply false. Among them, that world weather attribution was not created with litigation in mind, that NOAA's billion-dollar disasters, RIP, tabulation was scientifically valid, that SRES had 60, not 40 scenarios, and that RCP 8.5 has not been the most commonly used scenario in research and assessment. DK25 ignored all of our research that was accurately cited by DOE CWG, end quote. As Matthew Wilicki also observes, the so-called rebuttal screed about cherry-picking seems to imply that the data do in fact show increases in extreme weather, sea level rise, and so forth, but it doesn't. And Wilicki notes of a passage that RPJ also focused on, quote, the review leans on a rhetorical maneuver that weakens its own case. The absence of statistically significant trends in the historical records does not mean that changes are not occurring. That sentence concedes the core point. When the data are not significant, you do not have a detected trend, end quote. So this response is not an attempt to do science, it's an attempt to prevent it. And another thing, the press are busy assuring us that the UK just had its hottest summer ever. But the Daily Skeptic responds that much of the Met Office data comes from cities, and indeed airports, but the big issue is that they're also reporting data from over 100 weather stations that, quite literally, do not exist. They are making the numbers up, and those numbers say what they want them to say. In the newsletter, we also say, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Canada's supposed pivot away from wacky wokeness and green zealotry to productivity and balanced energy continues to flop, including putting the new nation-building project bureaucracy in the hands of the former CEO and current chair of the state-owned Trans Mountain Corporation, which oversaw completion of the absurdly expensive Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project, and who also seems to have the official Ottawa habit of excessive, even unlawful, secrecy about public affairs. Just the sort of socialized corporate insider you want to restore investor confidence. And then, from the Science Isn't Settled and Shouldn't Be file, we bring you a Newsweek item, quote, "Solar flare is more than 6 times hotter than thought as 50-year puzzle solved," end quote. And they seem chuffed that, quote, "the findings challenge prior assumptions in solar physics and suggest that ions are heated far more intensely than electrons during solar flares," end quote. So, let's see them express similar enthusiasm that, say, "Arctic ice not melting as thought." Guys, are you there? In the newsletter, we also ask, so, Trump was right? Because the Atlantic Weekly Planet runs a sob story about a guy who quit FEMA for a private disaster relief position in protest at Donald Trump's arbitrary anti-science meanness, only to encounter such adverse conditions as higher pay, greater job security, and more meaningful work. Isn't it awful? Ah, and in case you're planning to move somewhere, possibly to Bedlam, National Geographic asks, quote, "Are these cities ready to become climate havens? In the future, cities that survive climate change could be full of green spaces, smart buildings, and compact neighborhoods," end quote. Cities that survive climate change? And also, aren't they just describing nice old cities, you know, ones that escaped modernist urban theory? Ah, and speaking of green spaces, Canada's hapless 2 billion tree program has fallen slightly short, though only by 89%, at a cost that Blacklock's reporter reports is $250 million tax dollars and counting. But they're pleased with themselves. Quote, "To date, over 228 million trees have been planted, representing important progress," end quote, according to the Department of Natural Resources. Progress toward what? Planting your reputation 6 feet deep? In the newsletter, we also note that this summer it was so hot in Canada that it actually snowed in August. No, wait, not hot, it was climate-y. It hadn't snowed in that particular spot in August since 2001, but nothing to see here, folks. The snow is disappearing, except in Canada in August. The story really said so. But, once again, if heat is climate, cold can't be just weather. As, for instance, the Daily Mail's, quote, "A monster blizzard is set to dump the heaviest amount of snow of the ski season and bring gale-force winds and heavy rain to large parts of southeast Australia," end quote. And no, there's no prize for guessing what word does not appear anywhere in that story. In the newsletter, we further chortle that yet another major state-subsidized EV venture just collapsed in Canada. Even the government propagandist CBC admits, quote, "Quebec declares Northvolt battery plant partnership dead, loses $270 million investment. Minister had earlier said Northvolt bankruptcy wouldn't affect Quebec plant," end quote. And of course, no one will lose their job or indeed face any punishment for having once again incinerated the hard-earned taxes of millions of people on a fantasy, even after bypassing normal project review rules to get the money blazing faster and then lying about the implications. Instead, they pull that Canadian Jedi mind trick, where when some policy collapses, you don't need to see the numbers. In the newsletter, we also note the remarkable extent to which the environmental movement, and the climate wing that has consumed it, seem determined to burn rather than build bridges to centrists and normal people. In prose worthy of Radio Moscow in its prime, an August 26th fundraiser from The Guardian declares fossil fuels are a capitalist plot. Quote, "Why does capital love fossil fuels? It's not hard to explain. They exist in a small number of discrete locations where the right to exploit them can be owned and monopolized," end quote. And Britain's Green Party leader Zach Polanski sounds quite similar, even to the extent of seeming less interested in saving the planet than in denouncing wealth. Apparently, the Greens resent your green. And it's odd because, as we argued this March, there should be some natural common ground between conservatives and environmentalists, who, after all, were once known as conservationists, and whose insights about the superiority of organic to mechanical processes fit nicely with much genuine conservative thought, including about the evolution of society and the operations of the economy. But it does not resonate, oddly, with the thinking of most modern Green parties, who seem instead to have decided that the environment is basically a useful hammer for beating people into compliance with bog-standard, boring, mechanistic approaches to public policy. And then in the newsletter, we continue our Have It Both Ways series by noting a 2002 study of climate change in Indian rice yields, which found that the outlook was good. After running a series of crop simulation models, the author said, quote, the direct effect of climate change on rice crops in different agroclimatic regions in India would always be positive, irrespective of the various uncertainties. Rice yields increased between 1 and 16.8% in pessimistic scenarios of climate change, depending upon the level of management in the model used. These increases were between 3.5 and 33.8% in optimistic scenarios, end quote. Uh-oh, can't have that. But not to fear. 8 years later, a study appeared arguing that increases in daily maximum temperatures in India didn't appear to hurt rice crops, but increases in daily minimum temperatures would. Because, whatever. And the combined effect was, drumroll please, worse than we thought. In the newsletter, we then revisit our popular Sea Level Check series that took CDN readers on a round-the-world tour of coastal spots where long-term tide gauge data mostly revealed that sea levels were rising very slowly at rates that would not cause anything but minor inconvenience over the coming century. Yes, but, the alarmists say, sea level rise is now accelerating due to climate change, so it's actually going to be a catastrophe. But in a new study, two Dutch researchers, Hessel Voortman and Rob de Vos, have looked at tide gauge data from around the world and found that in almost every place they looked, there is no evidence of acceleration. And where acceleration does appear, it is usually caused by local land disruptions that are completely unconnected to climate. Moreover, the discrepancy between what the tide gauges are saying and what the satellites are saying is well known to those in the field. But the authors say, quote, without exception, we found papers attempting to close the budget by increasing the contributors to sea level rise, end quote. You see, the conclusion came first, that the seas are coming for us in response to our sins, and the trial was held later as a formality. But unfortunately, it seems that the real mean average sea level rise around the world is around 1.4 millimeters a year, and the median is 1.5, which works out to 14 or 15 centimeters in a century, easily handled with minor coastal infrastructure adjustments or additions. So there's nothing to see, as we said. Finally, from the co2science.org archive, the emblic tree in India bears a sour fruit that, according to Wikipedia, was likened in ancient Buddhist writing to all wisdom, in which case sagacity shall increase with CO2, because in 2004, 8 experiments found an additional 300 parts per million of carbon pollution yielded an average 165% increase in above-ground emblic seedling biomass. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson. And what experts say, I go back and check.
That's right.